It's 9:07, and this is an HPR.
The Man Booker.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When it comes to childhood anxiety, our guest today, therapist Lynn Lyons, has seen it all. Kids so worried they can't sleep at night, get on the school bus, socialize with others. Kids who are so fretful and so fearful they can't function normally and are at greater risk of depression down the road. Lyons is a Concord-based social worker and psychotherapist specializing in anxiety disorders. She's also co-author of the new book, Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. The book drills into why more children these days suffer unhealthy levels of worry to the point where 1 in 5 American kids have what Lyons calls a diagnosable anxiety disorder. And it also offers plenty of ideas about how families might rethink their approach toward children's fears, including parents looking at how they deal with their own anxiety. Today in The Exchange, are we raising Generation Anxious? Author and therapist Lynn Lyons is here, and let's get you into our conversation. Do you see an increase in anxious kids these days? If so, what's causing it? Are we over-testing, over-booking, overreaching with our kids? Are we over-diagnosing kids as anxious or just more aware of their struggles today than perhaps we used to be? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Lynn, it's great to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, what's healthy anxiety, Lynn, and what's unhealthy anxiety? I mean, childhood is associated with huge fears, you know, monsters under the bed, noises in the closet,
right.
The dark.
Well, and healthy anxiety is supposed to show up. Anxiety is a sign to you that says, hey, stop, take your time, back up. And so when we look at normal anxiety, developmentally, separation from a parent is a normal anxiety. Discovering being afraid of the dark is a normal anxiety. When kids start to hear about things like death, that's a normal anxiety. Suddenly kids become aware of the fact that parents die or grandparents die or pets die. That's a normal anxiety. Transitioning into something new, something unusual, something performance-based, normal anxiety. So all of those things, all of those worries, all of those sort of pauses that we take in life are absolutely normal. Those are going to happen, and we should expect them.
So what's unnormal? What's abnormal? What's unhealthy?
So unhealthy is when we start seeing kids avoiding things that we would consider developmentally appropriate. So a child that is not able to go to school, a child that is having such a difficult time separating from a parent that a parent might say, you know, we've never been able to have a babysitter with our child. A child who is starting to retreat from activities that they normally would have found fun or exciting. So a child that says, no, I'm not going to try out for the Little League team, or no, I don't really want to go to swimming lessons, or no, I'm not going to go to that birthday party. When we see avoidance, that's when we have to start paying attention.
Yeah. So how do you pick through it, though, Lynn? I mean, you know, and how do you know what kind of anxiety is worth just saying, look, Johnny, you'll get over it, go? And when is it anxiety that just seems to be not normal? I mean, I know you're getting at it, but just give us a little more, because, again, I think a lot of people listening will go, well, yeah, I was afraid when I tried out for Little League, or yeah, I was afraid when that sort of grumpy-looking babysitter arrived at the door.
Well, and it's sort of that old expression, feel the fear and do it anyway.
Yeah.
And anxiety is feel the fear and say, no, no, thank you. So what anxiety demands is certainty and comfort. So if you're trying to figure out what anxiety's agenda is, that's it, certainty and comfort. Now, certainty in life is impossible. And being comfortable all the time is impossible as well. But anxiety is such a taskmaster. The way I look at anxiety in a family, it's like a cult leader, C-U-L-T, a cult leader. And the whole family is beholden to the cult leader's demands of certainty and comfort. So where we see it crossing into the line of problematic or diagnosable is when no amount of information, no amount of reassurance is able to provide that child with a sense of, I can move forward. So what we see is constant asking. So I'll give you an example. Say a child is worried about whether or not mom's going to pick him up at school, after school. So he says, Mom, what time are you going to pick me up? And mom says, I'll be there at 3. Well, what happens if you're not there at 3? Well, go in and find an adult and they'll track me down. And a child who's not really suffering from a problematic anxiety will say, oh, okay. Now, when you have a child with anxiety, he can't close the certainty loop. So he says, well, what if you're not there at 3? Well, go find an adult. Well, what if adult isn't there? Well, you know there'll be an adult there. No, but one time I saw the principal leave early. Well, then find another teacher. Well, what if when they find you, we call you on your cell phone, and remember that time you didn't charge your cell phone and you couldn't get my message? I mean, so it's an unlimited amount of questions because they can't get certainty.
No matter what.
No matter what. Yeah. And that's when parents then step in and try and provide certainty. So they start doing all these things to make sure that they can get as close to certainty as possible. And anxiety is saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. So it gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
I like your analogy about it's a cult, and everyone in the family has to kind of, pay homage to this cult. And it
kind of throws
the whole family into dysfunction, even the kids and parents who aren't anxious.
Yeah, and that's something that comes up a lot, is that oftentimes if you've got one parent that's anxious and one parent that's not anxious, for example, the non-anxious parent very quickly gets marginalized, very quickly gets pushed off to the side. And the way that happens is, so say you've got this anxious mom and maybe an anxious kid, and the non-anxious parent, let's just say it's the dad. The dad says, you know what, I really think that Samantha can walk to the bus stop by herself. She's 12 years old. We live in a nice neighborhood. And then the anxious parent says,
you don't understand.
Right. Or even worse, well, fine, she can walk by herself. And if she gets kidnapped, then that's on you, fella. So the non-anxious parent isn't going to go there. Right. So the whole family begins to live by the rules of anxiety because it feels too risky to anybody who's anxious, and it feels too much work to somebody who's not.
That's exhausting.
It's exhausting.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, and then a lot more questions for you, Lynn. Again, the number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're sitting down with Lynn Lyons, New Hampshire-based therapist, co-author of the new book, Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. We're talking about this trend that she sees in rising childhood anxieties, looking at what's considered normal worry, what's unhealthy, and the role parents play in their children's anxiety struggles. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And then I have to say, I was struck by the statistic that you cite. 1 in 5 American children today suffer from some kind of diagnosable anxiety disorder. That high. I mean, that seems like a lot of kids. And I'm wondering how different that was from previous generations, our own generation included.
Yeah. So you and I, the statistics when we were growing up probably would have been about 1 in 10.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's doubled.
And depending on where you look, some say 1 in 8, some say 1 in 5. And people, that statistic gets people's attention. The number is less important to me than the fact that what we're seeing is that more and more kids are dealing with anxiety. The more that parents are anxious, the more that kids are anxious. And the real problem, actually, in anxiety disorders is what they lead to. So a child with an untreated anxiety disorder is very likely to develop depression by the time that they hit adolescence or early adulthood. And that becomes then the real issue that we're looking at these kids that are just not able to move forward, not able to launch. You know, you hear failure to launch, not able to make it in college, not able to move into the world with a sense of competence, with a sense of, you know, I can handle what life throws at me.
That's interesting, because we do hear stories about, you know, young adults living in mom and dad's basement and not really seeming to failure to launch. You do hear that a lot. Are you saying that that could be possibly childhood anxiety that was never addressed?
Yeah, not could be. We know from the research that it is. If you have episodes of anxiety in childhood as you're moving into the teenage years and it's not addressed, the likelihood of you staying at home is far greater than if you have dealt with the anxiety, learned the skills that you need to move forward. The good news is, though, is that anxiety is so treatable. I think that's why I like treating it. I like results. I'm a solution-focused therapist. Anxiety does not have to be chronic. It does not have to be permanent. We know that early intervention works fabulously. And so what we want to do is even proactively teach kids, teach families the skills that they need.
So what's causing this difference? And again, no point in quibbling about the numbers between our generation, earlier generations, and today's generation. But what are some of the top items that you see, Lynn, contributing to this?
I think that parents are more fearful. You know, I refer to the New Hampshire drowning report in the summer. You listen to the news. We hear about every kid. We hear about every disaster. We hear about every horrible thing that happens. It gives us the impression that the world is a lot more dangerous. It's not that much more dangerous. We just get that impression. And so parents have a lot going on in their imaginations about what can possibly happen to their childhood. And what anxiety is a worried thought shows up, grabs onto your imagination, you go catastrophic in your thinking, your imagining. So as you can imagine, we're sitting, we're hearing on the news, we're hearing about this horrible thing, that horrible thing. Our imagination starts to do its thing, and suddenly we want to protect our children from all these possible things that could go wrong.
So parents hear scary headlines and about, you know, child abductions or drownings or shootings at elementary schools. I mean, some of it's real.
It's real, yeah.
And then you get anxious and you transfer that to your children.
Right.
We'll talk more after a short break and take your phone calls, emails, Facebook comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. More conversation about childhood anxiety with Lynn Lyons in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. More on anxious kids, anxious parents on The Exchange, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, toxic chemical leaks in West Virginia and North Carolina. Partly to mostly sunny for this morning, clouding up this afternoon for most of the state. Mostly cloudy, chance of snow showers in Coos County. Windy highs today, lower 20s north, ranging lower 30s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from UR members in Balkus Law and Jennifer Balkus, with offices in Concord and Portsmouth, focusing on family law, divorce, and mediation. Diligent, thorough, and attentive. Online at balkuslaw.com. And the City of Claremont, information about Claremont's economic development initiatives and business relocation at claremontnh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with Lynn Lyons. She's a Concord-based clinical social worker, psychotherapist, and author of the new book, Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents, co-authored with Reed Wilson. We're taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Do you see an increase in anxious kids these days? If so, what do you think's causing it? Is it the scary headlines that parents see? Are we overreaching with our kids, overbooking them? Or perhaps are we overdiagnosing kids as anxious? Or perhaps we're just more aware of their struggles today than perhaps we were a generation or two ago. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Lynn, let's go right to our listeners. And Jeff is calling from Madbury. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have. We have two daughters, 7.5 months apart, one adopted, and the adopted is the anxious. She has one fear of always being taken, which I would love to know if we can how to rectify that. And my other question is, how do we get her to lose graciously? She cannot stand defeat, no matter what it is. If it's a game of war, or if she's at school and she's not on the winning team, she can't handle it.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff, for the call. What about that fear of being taken?
That's a pretty common one. One of the things that's really important to remember as you're dealing with anxiety with kids, and this is a hard thing for people to wrap their mind around, but the content doesn't matter. So when we're talking about fears that kids have, except for very specific instances, which I can give you an example of, but the content doesn't matter. An anxious kid's content changes based on the developmental cycle. So 6-year-olds do not worry about the same thing as 16-year-olds. So what's going on with a child who's afraid of being taken? Let's look at it generically. What they are saying is, the world is a dangerous place, and I can't handle it. So I often say to kids, this is what your anxiety says. Blah, 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 and you can't handle it. We can put anything in there.
Fill in the blank.
Fill in the blank, right? So this fear is, now what happens, and probably what's happening with Jeff as well, is that they are trying to provide certainty. So they're saying, oh, now, look, we live in a nice neighborhood. We have locks on the doors. I had one family, they put in a $50,000 alarm system.
No
because
kidding,
yeah,
wow.
And they bought a 150-pound dog. I mean, they're going to great lengths to provide certainty. So again, what you have to do with any child that's anxious is allow them to be uncertain. You're going to take reasonable precautions. We put our seatbelt on when we're in the car. We wear helmets when we ride our bikes. But we want to get out of the content and say, this is your worry talking. Your worry is grabbing onto your imagination. It's conjuring up these scenes of fill in the blank, and you feel incapable of handling it. So we want to stay out of the content, and we want to externalize that worry and say, there's your worry, saying the same old thing again, trying to sell you a bill of goods. Back off from the content and really focus on the fact that worry does the same thing over and over and over
again. No matter what it's about.
No matter what it's about, same process. Content doesn't matter. Process is where we want to focus.
So does that mean, Lynn, that the family that spent however many thousands on the security system at home and the big dog, they wasted their money?
Yeah, it didn't work.
Wow.
Actually, because worry came up with another way of feeling unsafe.
Now I'm worried about clowns or cars.
Well, you know what? If it's a really good criminal, they'll know how to disarm that alarm system. Or, you know, what happens if the dog is asleep and doesn't hear? There's that constant questioning, that constant need for reassurance, trying to get 100% certainty, which is just impossible.
You know, you talked earlier, Lynn, about one of the big reasons why children are more anxious today is because parents are more anxious mm-hmm. today. And we talked about parents seeing scary headlines, you know, abducted children on milk cartons mm-hmm. and very real scary things like the Newtown mm-hmm. shootings or in shopping malls or the movie theater. I have to confess, a couple weeks ago, I let my older boy go hang out at the mall and then go to the movies with his friends. And I turned and looked at my husband and said, oh, my gosh, mall and movie, you know.
Right.
I said, Laura.
Good for you.
Laura, because not every child who goes to a mall or a movie is going to get shot, obviously.
Correct.
But it's very easy to get sucked in by that.
Right. Well, because as parents, we want to keep our kids safe. So the tricky part about dealing with an anxious child, particularly if you're an anxious parent, is that you yourself are trying to create certainty for your own well-being. How do we keep a child safe 1,000% of the time.
You can't.
It's impossible. You know, remember in Concord when they were shifting the schools around and our kids were going to different schools when they were building, right? And I remember sending the fifth, I think they were in fifth grade that year, sending the fifth graders off to find their new school and pushing them out the door. We took a little dry run, but saying to my son, all right, well, good luck. Remember, you got to take a right here and not a left. And then sort of keeping fingers crossed and no news is good news and assuming that they all made it. And there was a little adventure along the way. But our ability to say to our kids, step into the world, take some risk, fail, get a few bumps and bruises along the way, that is a critical parental stance to take if we're trying to equip kids with what they need so that they can handle what life throws at them. An anxious parent removes that, takes that away, and that fosters anxiety.
So do parents today not want their kids to A, take risks, and B, fail?
Correct. Yeah.
They're looking for absolute certainty, so...
Not
and
all
transferring
parents.
That. Not all
parents.
But that's a cultural value.
That's a cultural value. Now, look, then we have technology. So now we can track our kids. We can know exactly where they are. Many parents that I see will come to me, and many parents that I see are anxious, and their kids are anxious. The statistics are that if you are an anxious child, 65% of anxious kids have an anxious parent. Parents are saying, when you get on the bus, text me. When you... get to school, text me. When you get home from school, text me. We want to know. So technology is allowing us to really not have that experience of not knowing where our kids are. That's a healthy thing, to not know where your kids are.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I did want to ask you that. The technology mm-hmm. is very helpful, mm-hmm. but it also does... tend to strengthen these tendencies to always be checking.
Correct. There's the certainty again, right? So we have to know. So think of how dependent people are on their technology to know everything. We have an expectation. It's almost become automatic that we know everything. We know what the weather is going to be. We know where our kids are. We know everything, or so we think. And then that ability to handle things when that is not available. When kids are saying, but what if your cell phone isn't charged? Or what if I lose my cell phone? What if I can't find you? That fosters anxiety because anxiety's message is you can't handle it.
Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest today is Concord-based therapist and co-author Lynn Lyons. The book she co-authored with Reed Wilson is called Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. Let's hear from you. What do you see around you in terms of childhood anxieties? Do you think they're on the rise? If so, what do you think is causing it? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. Post a comment there. Here's an email that came in. This person wished to remain anonymous, Lynn, and we will honor that. As a teacher, I see a lot of kids unable to cope because their parents have always rescued them from any discomfort. They swoop in whenever the child makes any mistake, and so the child never experiences natural consequences of their choices. He or she misses the chance to deal with minor problems and learn that he can solve problems. The kids come across as both anxious and spoiled. Am I reading this correctly? I want to thank that person for the email, especially given your experience as a teacher.
Yeah, so I like the phrase swoop in. And even if you're not an anxious parent, we have a lot of swoopers out there. One of the things we know from the research, the skills that anxious kids don't have, they are lousy problem solvers, and they have a lot of trouble tolerating uncertainty. And so when we are working with a family, it's very common to see over and over and over again that the parent doesn't want their child to fail, doesn't want them to feel uncomfortable, doesn't want them to pay the consequences. And so what we need to work on is allowing kids to fail. And I will say to parents over and over and over again, you've got to let him fail. Don't check Power School. There's another example of technology. Power School is the thing at the high school where you can look and see exactly what your child did, what homework assignment they passed in, what grade they got, whether or not they were late for a class. It's a tool that allows parents to overmanage. So this teacher has a very good point, is that we're not letting kids make mistakes. We're not letting them fail. We can stay on top of them. I've got parents, and the kids will tell me, the high school kids will come in and say, my dad checks Power School every morning, and at breakfast, we discuss every assignment, every quiz, every test that I have done. I had one girl tell me the other day, you know, when I get a bad grade, it's then my job to fix it. It's my job to go to the teacher to find out how I can retake the test, but my dad is right there to make sure that I'm on top of it. And I need some space. I need some autonomy. I need some independence.
So are you saying Concord High School should get rid of Power School?
Well, I don't know. maybe what they should do is only limit. Maybe if you check it more than twice a week, a big red X comes up and says back
limited
off.
Access.
Right.
Let's take another call. And this is Mary in Sunapee. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. What a great show. I have to say, this is like an answer to my prayers. I have a 15-year-old who definitely, you know, has chronic anxiety, and my big thing was trying to give him the tools to deal with this the rest of his life. But the way I did this was take him to a therapist and a psychiatrist. So a couple of questions. Is there a link to intelligence and anxiety? Because I heard that there was. And my other question is, how do you feel about, while they're going through therapy, using medication? My son started on Prozac, and it seems to have helped at least get him to the point where he can go through therapy.
You know, it's a great question, Mary, one I had as well. So thank you. Go ahead, Lynn.
So the link to IQ, not necessarily. I think that really anxious kids tend to be more articulate. They're thinkers, so they've got busy brains up there, and they're usually working through things. And what I see in my practice a lot is I see a lot of really, really bright, articulate kids who are thinking too much, and a lot of families who are really focused on giving their child the best opportunity. So sometimes there's a little bit of pressure there, but we don't see a link between IQ and anxiety per se in the research. The medication question.
It's a big question.
It is a big question. So my practice, Mary, the way that I handle this is that if a child comes to see me and they're not on any medication and anxiety has been an issue, I will say, let's hold off a little bit. Let's hold off 3, 4, 5 sessions. Let's see if we can get the tools in place to see a difference in the way that your child is functioning. On the other hand, medication has its place as a way to support, as you said, to support what's going on with a child in psychotherapy. There are certain medications that I am not in favor of. I'm not in favor of using benzodiazepines with children, which are the Xanax, Klonopin, Valium, as we know them.
Anti-anxiety drugs.
Anti-anxiety drugs. And we can talk a little bit about what they do to the brain, which would be a helpful
the developing
piece of,
brain.
The developing brain and the part of the brain that needs some retraining. But we can address that in a minute. So what you're seeing is your son is able to do the therapy because the medication is maybe giving him a little bit of a hardwood floor to stand on. Medication should not be considered a permanent solution for kids that are anxious. It's so treatable. And as long as your child is in good therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, very active, should be homework assignments, then you're on the right track.
So let's talk a little bit more about medication then, because It seems you've got some strong feelings there. go ahead, Lynn, because it sounded like you wanted to dig into that a little bit more.
Well, so benzodiazepines, those are the drugs that what they do is they put the amygdala to sleep. What we know in terms of dealing with anxiety is that in order to change the way that the brain is thinking and working when it handles anxiety is that the amygdala needs to be retrained.
And it can't be retrained if it's asleep.
Correct. So it's a good short-term. I mean, the reason that these pills are so widely prescribed and the reason that they become so habit-forming is because they work like a charm. So say you were going on a trip and you were terrified to fly, but you really wanted to go to your cousin's wedding in Hawaii. And so your doctor says, look, I'm going to give you two Xanax. Take them before you get on the plane. They'll get you through the flight. Fine. But to put a child on a medication that is highly habit-forming, very difficult to get off, and puts the amygdala to sleep is in direct contrast to what I am doing in therapy, which is taking that amygdala out for a walk, taking it into the situation that causes the anxiety, using the coping strategies that we work on, and then having the amygdala say, oh, well, maybe this isn't so bad. The amygdala is a primitive part of our brain that responds to danger messages. And what it does is, so remember I told you the worry generates those worried thoughts, grabs onto the imagination, and then sends a message to the amygdala. Basically, what I call it with kids is an oh no message, a danger message. The amygdala says, geez, Lynn's in trouble. Gets the body juiced up, sends message down to those adrenals, gets that epinephrine going, gets that fight or flight response going. That's what anxiety is. The problem is the amygdala needs to experience the situation, needs to be able to say, wait a second, you've been telling me that elevators are life-threatening. I just went up and down this elevator five times. Nothing happened. Maybe I better reconsider. If the amygdala is asleep, that can't happen.
So I like your imagery. Take the amygdala out for a walk. Mm-hmm. Get it used to this idea that, or retrain it to the idea that, yeah, some things are anxiety provoking and they should be, like a truck coming at you down the street.
Right.
A lot of kids ask you in your practice, Lynn, well, if my amygdala is causing me so much trouble, why can't I just remove it?
Right. And I did have a I did have a little girl ask me that. It was so cute. I think she was about 6 years old. And she said, well, could we just remove my amygdala? And the response to that is, you need your amygdala. Your amygdala is there. I was riding my bike a few summers ago, and there was this big, huge dog on a chain. And I sort of looked at that dog, and I thought, oh, I'm glad that dog is on a chain. And then that dog lunged forward. His collar, as if it were made of toilet paper, just sort of burst off his neck, and he was after me, and he meant business.
Wow.
And my amygdala got the message of danger. My amygdala shot that epinephrine, that adrenaline through my system, and I pedaled like the wind, and I didn't get attacked by that dog. That's why we need our amygdala. The problem with anxiety is that the amygdala is misfiring. It's getting false alarms over and over and over again because there's nothing that's saying, I can handle this, to keep that danger message from getting to the amygdala.
Well, and we all know how plastic kids' brains are, and I'm wondering if adult amygdalas can be retrained.
Sure. Adult amygdalas can be retrained. I would say it's a little harder. Maybe that groove is a little deeper. The key to all of this is motivation. I have had people who have been determined to deal with their anxiety because there is something that they really want. And kids, it's the same way. Gotta have a want to.
All right. Lots more conversation with Lynn Lyons. Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents is the book that she co-authored with Reed Wilson. We'll talk more in just a moment and take a lot more of your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, toxic chemical leaks in West Virginia and North Carolina, then the race to build America's first subway, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, partly sunny this morning, then clouding up this afternoon for most of the state. Mostly cloudy, chance of snow showers in Coos County. Windy highs today, lower 20s north, ranging lower 30s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and Bernstein Shores Education Law Group, providing sound legal counsel to New Hampshire's public and private educational institutions in Manchester and BernsteinShore.com. And the New Hampshire Moose License Plate Program, thanking drivers for supporting the Granite State's natural, historical, and cultural heritage. Information online at mooseplate.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the debate over how best to help the nation's long-term unemployed. Today in The Exchange, Lynn Lyons is here, New Hampshire-based author and psychotherapist, talking about her new book, Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents, and the rising trend of childhood anxiety that she sees. Join us with your observations, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Here's an email in that came in a little bit ago from Scott in Jackson. He says, what effect do the safety measures taken by schools in the face of a perceived increased risk of school violence have on the anxiety level of the students? Scott says, I think whether the risk is any greater than it used to be or whether the measures taken are truly effective are both questionable. I've heard this generation of kids called Generation Lockdown, Lynn. They do have drills where they take measures that they're supposed to take if a school shooter comes in.
Right. And, you know, I was talking to somebody who's a lot older than you and I, and he said we used to have drills in school for nuclear bombs,
duck
right?
And cover.
That's right. We had to get under the desks. I was also talking to somebody who lived in London during World War II. So he said, you think you guys live in a dangerous environment.
Right. Air raids,
air raids, all that kind of stuff. So it's not a new thing. I think, again, the content changes, but there seems to be throughout history, there are significant threats. I think for kids, the way to approach these lockdown drills is that we are doing something to help you have a plan. The problem with anxious kids is that they can take a lockdown drill and they amplify it so that the threat feels constant, so that those imaginations, again, they worry about it. What if, what if, what if, what if?
Sure, like the examples you gave before. What if the burglar's really good
right.
and he can disable the alarm
right.
system?
Right. So if you have kids that aren't particularly anxious, just like with fire drills or anything else, they say, okay, this is what I need to do. They go through the motions. They handle it. With kids who have a propensity for anxiety, this will increase their anxiety or introduce them to new content that then the anxiety grabs hold of. Should we do lockdown drills with in schools? Yeah, I mean, I think we do fire drills. We do lockdown drills. In our own families, we have a plan that if the house catches on fire. And the issue is that if you have a kid who's likely to be anxious and likely to be a worrier, these lockdown drills can certainly cause an issue. But I'll tell you, I've been doing this for 25 years. We didn't used to have lockdown drills, but there were plenty of kids who were just as scared as about fire drills. We don't have to deal with earthquakes, but I've got colleagues who live on the West Coast. They have earthquake drills. It's a real fine line between preparation and scaring. And unfortunately, that's the fine line that we walk when we're trying to keep our kids safe.
Well, and we have heard that these drills in some terrible situations have helped
yes,
kids.
Right.
They knew to go into the bathroom
right.
and lock the door. They
right.
knew what to do. So what do you do for that 1 in 5 kid who is made more anxious by this?
Well, again, we want to stay out of the content. So the thing that you can do that's so helpful is we want to externalize the worry. So that worry is going to show up, and that worry is going to say something, what if blank. And what you want to do is stay out of the content and say, there's your worry showing up. We're not going to engage in a conversation with it. We're not going to spend a lot of time answering its questions. We're going to do what we need to do, and then we're going to be able to feel equipped. We want kids to feel equipped. Another example that I've dealt with before is a young kid watches a family member die of cancer and then comes in and says, what if my mom gets cancer? Well, mom could get cancer. Right? Or says, what if I go to sleep at night and I don't wake up in the morning? Well, I mean, I guess that could happen.
But you can't
right?
stay awake all night.
You can't stay awake all night, right? So we want to keep them out of the content and be able to say, worry shows up, says the same thing all the time. So a kid who's afraid of a lockdown drill, worry's going to show up and say, oh, what if we have a lockdown drill today? Or what if somebody comes in the school and hurts me? We want to say, oh, there's my worry bugging me again. Worry, I know what to do, we've practiced, and I'm not going to let you rule my life. I've got plenty of other things to focus on. I'm going to put you over here. You're going to show up. I want kids to be bored by what their worry says because it says the same thing over and over and over again.
Now, it almost sounds like that's good advice for parents, too, because, you know, as a parent, you read about these incidents at schools or mm-hmm. malls or whatever, and you can't help but get anxious
right.
yourself.
Right. And sure, I mean, the same thing happens. What if you hear about a friend whose child gets killed in a car accident? What if you hear about a friend whose child is diagnosed with leukemia? There comes that worry that says, what if? And we need to be able to say, thanks for checking in, worry, but I've got a lot more that I need to get done today.
All right. Easier said than done.
Way easier said than done.
You. Yeah. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Maureen's been waiting in Laconia. Hi, Maureen. You're on the air with Lynn Lyons. Go ahead.
Hi, Lynn. I just wanted, you're explaining how the imagination takes over. Mm-hmm. And I've always used an expression and passed it on called awfulizing.
Oh, yes. I've heard that.
In one word, it says when somebody tells me, oh, this is going to happen, I say, stop awfulizing.
Right, right. And we would call that the clinical jargon we would use for that is that we would say catastrophic thinking or catastrophizing.
That's right? Too much for me.
Well, awfulizing sounds a lot easier to say, doesn't it?
It does. But the other thing I wanted to mention was that you're so right about parents' anxiety and being a grandma. It's so depressing when I'm in a supermarket and there's a beautiful little child sitting in the mama's cart, mama's pushing the cart, and I just lean over. Oh, what beautiful curls. Mama gets panicked.
Yeah.
She pulls away with that cart. Now, what does that say to that child?
That everybody's a molester. Huh?
That's right. And that's another thing I think, and shout out to all parents in supermarkets with little children. Please let someone admire your child and just say, thank you, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And Maureen, it's so good to hear from her because I do see some real generational differences here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we know that anxiety is generational. So you're seeing generational differences. What I often see, actually, with the families in my office is that this has been passed down from generation to generation. So I have one family, we say that the little girl is the bronze medal winner of anxiety. Mom is the silver medal winner. Grandma was the gold medal winner. So there are differences in generations in the non-anxiety part of it in terms of being able to send your kid out to play, being able to send your kid out into the world to do things. But if you've got anxiety in your family, it probably goes back several generations. And it's a real combination of a genetic component. There is a genetic component to it, but a real learned pattern of behavior. The world is a scary place.
I guess what I was trying to get at there, Lynn, with the generational comment was that today's generation seems to be more concerned than perhaps past generations. Mm-hmm. I remember coming across a statistic with an author who's written about, I think it was Carl Honoré, Overpressured Kids. Mm-hmm. And he came across a statistic that, you know, grandfather sort of was allowed to roam within a radius of 8 miles. Dad was allowed to roam within a radius of 1 mile. Son is either in the house or the backyard. So there does seem to be this closing in of the circle within which we allow our children to experience the world.
Yes.
And experience others.
Yes, absolutely. We have to know where they are. I've had plenty of parents who don't let their children play unsupervised in their own backyard. And walking to school, taking the bus to school, there are plenty of parents where a child is supposed to get on the bus, but the child is driven to school every day because the bus isn't a safe place to be, that bad things happen on the bus. So, yeah, I absolutely think that the radius of how far we let our kids range is definitely coming in. Yeah, I agree with you.
What about, there's also a common critique. Again, it's easy to criticize, mm-hmm. but there is a common critique of kids not getting outside enough, not having enough unstructured play where they have to figure out what mm-hmm. to do. If you're on a screen, then the screen is kind of guiding you what to do. You know, you throw kids outside and they say, I'm bored. There's
right.
nothing to do. What about that, Lynn? Does that lead to anxious kids if they're just not out enough?
Yeah, we know that exercise, physical activity, is a really great treatment for anxiety and depression. And the more sedentary that kids and adults are, the less they do in terms of mental health. I say often, if people came to see me, if there was one thing that I could make them do, they had to do, I could only pick one thing, I would say, move your body, exercise, get outside.
More than anything else.
More than anything else. If I could only choose one thing, if I had one shot at it, that's what I would say. And letting kids be out in the world, both physically and socially, is so important. One of the things that kids learn when they're just hanging out with friends and dealing with the social issues is problem solving. They learn that you fail. They learn, the caller earlier that said that her daughter, or I forget who it was, that said the daughter was really had a difficult time losing. That is the experience that comes when adults aren't around monitoring every aspect of their child's interactions and social play and achievement and that kind of stuff. So unstructured play, letting them figure things out, is so important.
Easier in earlier generations when more parents were home.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
There was at least a couple moms. Usually it was the mom around in the neighborhood that you could check in with just in case somebody, you know, fell down and broke their arm.
Right. Right. And I think that there's that overscheduled and we have a lot of pressure for achievement now. So we want our kids. I'll give you an example. I was talking a long time ago to somebody who's also a therapist, actually. My child was in kindergarten. And I said, well, I'm going to sign him up for soccer. And the guy said, well, how old is he? And I said, well, he's almost six. He said, has he played before? I go, oh, no, we just started. He said, might be too late.
Oh.
I thought, really?
Yeah. So six?
Yeah. And I guess he was right because he hasn't turned into a soccer player. But, yeah, he was 6 years old.
So you should have started him at two,
Lynn. Guess I should have started him at two. Yeah. So that is the struggle in our society, is we're so busy. We've got so much on our plate. We want our kids to be safe. We want our kids to not be hanging out. I think the other thing, too, is that letting kids hang out in our generation, if you were hanging out, think back to all the games that you came up with. The games that we had in my neighborhood that we invented, we had to come up creatively with these games. They don't have to do that anymore. And so when we had unstructured time or we had time to fill, we used our brains in productive ways. We figured things out. We problem solved. We failed.
We got into trouble.
We got into trouble. We made messes. But now it's really a lot harder. This sounds silly, but it's a lot harder sometimes to get into trouble when mom or some caretaker is watching you every minute of the day.
Or when hangout time means, you know,
right,
playing on the Xbox.
Right. Right. And we want to have kids have structured things because we know if we let them hang out, they're going to be in front of a screen. And so we're trying to say less screen time. So let's put them in this activity. Let's put them in that activity. Yeah, because we don't want them to be involved in those screen time things. We're not doing so well.
Let's take another call. Jennifer is waiting in Springfield, Vermont. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi there. I really enjoyed this conversation as an adult who, when I was much younger, suffered from anxiety. I wonder whether there's also a reframing that's possible. We've been thinking or speaking about anxiety as a deficit, something that needs to be conquered or ignored or minimized, but perhaps anxiety or the overactive amygdala could be an asset that children could learn to channel into things like creative pursuits, the arts, working hard, so that it's not, you know, sort of like hyperactive physically. We think, oh, get out there and run around, have some freedom. So is that something that you've thought about?
You know, Jennifer, this is a great point. And we often read, Lynn, in articles about stress, for example, that you don't want no stress or you just lie on the couch like a wet noodle. So Jennifer's saying, some anxiety is good. It gets you up. It gets you to study for the test, et cetera.
Sure. And that's a really good point. I have a book deadline, and I'm anxious about that. And if I had no anxiety about that, really yesterday I wouldn't have sat in front of my computer for 7 hours because it was a beautiful day. So some anxiety is good. The thing, though, about channeling anxiety is that once it gets to the point where it is overwhelming. The thing that anxiety does is it shuts down creativity. It shuts down thinking.
It's debilitating.
So, yeah. When that amygdala is fired up, when that anxious process is going on, your prefrontal cortex, which is where you problem solve, that's your executive function, that's a higher levels in our brain, that goes offline. So it's harder to, some anxiety is good, motivating, normal, necessary. But when it crosses over into avoidance, then we lose the ability to be anxious. To be creative. We lose the ability to think things through. We lose the ability to be motivated because avoidance becomes the name of the game.
Here's an email that I want to share with you, Lynn, and I'll make it quick because we're running to the end. And this person also wishes to remain anonymous. This person says, my spouse suffers from anxiety, sees a counselor. I'm concerned about the potential impact on our two young children as they get older. Interested in strategies that might prevent anxiety from developing in children when they're in a family situation where it's present in a parent.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's exactly what Reed and I were going after when we wrote the book.
It's not just for kids.
Right. The book is actually written for parents, and it says to parents, there are things that you can do. So what you really want your spouse to do, the fact that he's getting treatment for it is great, but you have to be really proactive, and by you I mean both of you, that you have to be a team to make sure that you want to avoid catastrophizing or awfulizing, as the caller said earlier, that you want to be really aware of your safety chatter, that you want to make sure, again, remember that anxiety is this cult leader, and when anxiety shows up and starts bossing you around, make sure that you say to that anxiety, I'm not going to let you boss my children around as well. The thing we see the most with anxious parents is we see the safety chatter, the catastrophizing, the world is a dangerous place, I'm not going to let you fail.
Well, I want to thank that person for the email. And just real quick, Lynn, so big picture, long term, how hopeful are you that we're going to be able to get a handle on this as a society?
Well, it depends on the day, I tend to be a very optimistic person. The thing about anxiety, it's so, so treatable, and you can do things, and it's not complicated. Anxiety is dramatic in its presentation, but it is so simple. It does the same thing over and over again, and I think that these kinds of conversations, and I think people should feel hopeful that we can do things as parents that make a huge difference.
All right, Lynn, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's Lynn Lyon. Again, Concord-based psychotherapist, social worker, and co-author of the new book, Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Nate Graby. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, understanding long-term unemployment. Extended jobless benefits were cut off late last year, affecting 2 million Americans who fear the longer they're out of the labor force, the harder it is to get back in. We'll examine what these workers experience and the debate over how to help them, including whether they or employers should adjust their expectations. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio. New Hampshire weather, partly sunny for this morning, clouding up this afternoon for most of the state, mostly cloudy, chance of snow showers in Coos County, windy today, highs lower 20s north, ranging lower 30s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Pax World Mutual Funds, a leader in sustainable investing, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision-making, paxworld.com for tomorrow.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Holbrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In early January, thousands of gallons of a toxic chemical leaked into West Virginia's Elk River. The accident caused contamination of the water supply in 9 counties. Earlier this month, a broken pipe owned by Duke